Hello, and welcome to Brokenomics. In this episode, we're going to be talking about one of my favourite subjects, which is central bank digital currencies, or CBDCs short. Now, this is one of the things that I first started really pushing on when I sort of made my transition from, you know, private citizen to somebody who had a bit of a profile. It was pushing back on things like central bank digital currencies. And I put out this long thread, which we flash up on screen for you, which was basically looking at the developments in the crypto market. It was looking at the state of the financial system and saying, you know, it logically follows that we are going to be getting at some stage a central bank digital currency. Now, back when I put that out, that was still considered to be a conspiracy theory. We were told from Rishi Sunak, who was the chancellor at the time, that he had absolutely no intention to release what was then being called a Britcoin. Well, we've transitioned a bit from that line of thinking. We've now got multiple job offers going up on the websites, the Bank of England and the Treasury, recruiting people who have the skill set to implement this. In fact, we now have reports being put out on a fairly regular basis saying that 90% of central banks around the world are looking at rolling out their own central bank digital currency. So what is a CBDC? Well, it's a digital currency which is issued and controlled by the central bank. Now, there is a little bit of overlap between what we covered last week, the Bitcoin, and central bank digital currencies, although central bank digital currencies, they do have somewhat of a separate lineage and are designed really to implement, to optimize the existing financial system. Now, there have been forerunners of this kind of thing. So one of them would be Finland's e-money system. This, I believe, was called Evant, and that was rolled out back in the 1990s. And also the Czech Republic, they had e-money system. And I think it was called Q, and that rolled out in the early 2000s. Now, Bitcoin, on the other hand, was designed to be an entirely new financial system that operated outside of this whole framework, whereas central bank digital currencies are really designed to, well, they were designed in response to cryptocurrencies to shore up the existing system. And they're very much focused on things like payment efficiencies and basically giving the central bank and the government far more control that they have now. There's also a potted history of private firms trying to get in on a similar vein to stuff like this. So Facebook started working on a digital currency and they called it Libra. And that was really the first time that the US government and probably other governments started to realize the scale of the threat of not developing their own system, that it was going to be done by big tech, and then they would lose one of their most powerful weapons, which is control of the currency. And they basically told Facebook to shut down their Libra project, and that's when they started getting really serious. And that was what alerted me to the fact that central bank digital currencies would almost certainly be becoming sooner or later, whether we liked it or not. A central bank digital currency is a type of digital payment which is centrally controlled by the government, and you need their permission to use it. You will remember that from last week that Bitcoin is not controlled by anyone, and you have no one's permission is necessary to use it. Anybody who can access the internet can generate a Bitcoin wallet and start transacting with other people. Where the central bank digital currency, you would have to submit yourself to a whole range of verification process in order to get onboarded to it, and then they would know exactly who you are and they can monitor you very closely. The other thing to talk about is we talked about in the last episode, the What on Bitcoin, about how blockchains are controlled by multiple nodes. Those miners that we got into, each of those is a Bitcoin node, but you can also run a node without doing any mining on your home computer. You just need a couple of gigabytes space of storage on your hard drive. You need an internet connection. You can run a Bitcoin node, and you can help decentralize the network. Now, what central bank digital currencies are designed to run on is something called a distributed database. Now, that is centrally controlled. It might have a distributed set of servers that it's running on, but all of the centralized control and command, or the authority, the decision making, that reverts back to a single node, a single point of failure. Now, with Bitcoin, an update, it is possible, but it's really hard to achieve because you need to get those nodes on board to adopt it. And it has happened before, but it has to be things that are very much in the interest of the whole Bitcoin network. So if you wanted to introduce something that made it more friendly to government and less friendly to individuals, it's just impossible at this point to get something like that through on the Bitcoin network. With central bank digital currencies, though, because there is only one node and it's centrally controlled, you've only got one decision maker. So you can make changes as frequently and to any scale of magnitude that you wish to change what it is that you can do with it. And that's what they're really all about. It's the tool set that it gives governments and central bankers. If you remember the video that I did, was it number two or three, something like that, where I talked about interest rates, we discussed how basically central banks, they don't have many tools at their disposal. The main one is interest rates, move it up or down. They can create money, but they find it very, very difficult to destroy money. And they've got a few other minor tools as well, but essentially it's just the interest rate thing. So you'll start to see when we get into this just how valuable and how attractive a central bank digital currency would be for them, because it gives them a whole suite of tools. Basically, anything they can dream up, they can have. So as I mentioned, they can't really destroy money at the moment, not easily. This would give them the ability to do it. But they can also do other things. They can set expiry dates on the money. They can control where it goes, where it can't go. They can impose limits. I mean, the lot. So let me take you to a potential future. This is a rather dystopian vision that I'm going to give you, but none of it is inconsistent with the tool set that a central bank digital currency would give you. So imagine this future. You're paid at 1 minute past midnight on Monday morning with digital pounds into your central bank wallet. Now, these digital pounds come with the premise that if they're not spent by midnight on Sunday, they will cease to exist. And that's to incentivize you to get out there and be a good little consumer. In addition, your digital wallet tracks your purchases. So it can decide, perhaps, that you've already exceeded your carbon quota for that month. So you're not allowed to buy any petrol. You're only allowed to hire a bicycle or catch a bus. It can also decide that perhaps you've had a bit too much red meat or alcohol. So you can only buy bug meat or soy meat substitutes, or you can only buy, you know, non-alcohol substitutes. Every transaction can be taxed at the point of transaction. So one of the ways that they're going to sell it will be on convenience. You don't have to do a tax return anymore because everything is taxed at the moment you do it. And of course, that applies to fines as well. If you go through a speed camera, or you say something hateful online with their ever-expanding definition of hateful, they can fine you on the spot that very instance. They can also do other things to combat climate change. They can make sure that your money doesn't work more than 15 minutes travel from your house for, say, 50 days a year. And, you know, 50 days a year, you're allowed to travel more than 15 minutes from your home and your money will work. But on the 51st day, your money will stop working. If you're more than 15 minutes from your place of residence, that's possible. You might find in this dystopian future that I'm describing that you can't watch the Lotus Eaters anymore because all of those guys have been accused of being freedom deniers or something. And they've had their ability to access the internet and create content has all been turned off for them. And at the end of the week, you've not used all of your paycheck. You've got some left over. And this is despite the fact that you've got plenty of digital experiences or avatars that you can download, lots of digital content for you to download and interact with. But for whatever reason, you haven't spent all of your salary. And you get this idea into your head that you want to save and invest because one day you would like to get out of the 9-to-5 grind. But you can't access any financial products because the regulators have decided that those are best saved for what they decided are sophisticated investors, and you don't qualify for that. So the only thing that you can access to invest in is government debt, because that is, of course, the safest investment, which is the line they will take. So you look up and you see an advert for investing in government debt with a negative 2% interest rate and a 10-year term. So you think, well, it's just going to be destroyed anyway, so I might as well invest in this. So you click on that, and then you discover that actually, because you have indigenous privilege, that minus 2% rate is only available to recent immigrants. And that your personalized rate, which takes into account your purchases, your political opinions, where you live, and other immutable characteristics that you may have that could be scored, that your personalized rate is a interest rate of minus 6.37%. And that's the rate on offer for you. Now, is this future? Well, obviously, none of the governments that are working on these things are selling that sort of vision. But here's the problem. That vision that I've just described is entirely consistent with the set of tools that they have announced that they are working on for these things. The only difference between the vision that they are trying to sell you with these things and the vision that I've just given you, this more dystopian vision, is a political choice. It is purely a choice to them whether you get A or B, because everything that I've just listed in that is possible under the powers that they are currently in the process of designing for themselves. So to be clear, what are these tools? Well, these tools include a limit on how much currency that you can have, how big your bank balance can go before it gets capped, automatically taxing your transactions, automatically blocking transactions, freezing your money if they decide that you need to. Maybe you've been to a protest or something and they need to freeze your account. Negative interest rates, they can apply that. They can't really do negative interest rates at the moment, because at the moment we've got an interbank rate. So you can't get banks to borrow to be short each other's reserves and get paid for doing that. So negative interest rates are really difficult for the system to do at the moment. The central bank digital currency, which they apply at the individual level, we don't all have to have the same negative interest rate. That becomes relatively easy. They can put expiry dates on it, as in my example. They can put location limits in. They can do limits on spending. They can decide what can and can't be bought. And they can design custom parameters for people on all of the above attributes. Everything on that list that I've just given you are things that the Bank of England, the Federal Reserve, Bank of Japan, the Bank of Canada, the ECB, the European Central Bank, and the Reserve Bank of Australia, they've all said that they are working on this set of tools. I'm not making this up. This is the set of tools that they're doing. And so the only thing that determines what they decide is a political choice. This is why it's so dangerous. Another thing to bear in mind, who holds this money? So as we talked about last week with Bitcoin, you can hold the Bitcoin in your own wallet if you want to, or you can let a custodian who you trust look after it for you, or you can even just leave it on the exchange that you bought it on. A lot of people do that. If you're not familiar with the process at all, that might be your best option, but really you should skill yourself up to when you can use your own wallet. Use something like a Ledger or a Trezor or something like that. But you have a choice. And our current system, actually, even our legacy financial system, is quite fragmented. So there is loads of different banks, you know, Lloyds, HSBC, Barclays, all of those. And there's also even non-banks like, I know, PayPal and other things as well that you can keep your money with. So at the moment, it's quite a hassle for government if they want to go after your money. And they generally only go for this level of hassle if it's a serious fraudster or criminal or dissident or a Russian oligarch or something somebody who the regime really wants to get, because it's quite cumbersome. You have to prepare separate court orders to go to different banks who you suspect hold the money and then find out what they own and then get a court order that puts a specific control on each of those. So in a fragmented system, it's quite difficult to freeze or seize your money. But with a classic central bank digital currency, it's a lot easier because all of the money is held at the central bank. So it's all there. So they have complete oversight over the whole lot of it. In fact, you don't even need, in a classical CBDC system, you don't even need the banking sector at all. It's all done at the central bank level. So, of course, if you never take possession of the money, well, it's never really yours. It's the central bank's money, and some of it has your name logged against it, that you're effectively using it for that time. And actually, the WEF has said, and they put out a central bank digital currencies and stable coins report a couple of years ago. And one of the things they're pushing for is that central banks will assign a social credit score to your wallet held with a central bank that will determine what you can and can't do with it. So that's what they're pushing for. And of course, the complete absence of privacy in this model as well. Because if it's all held at the central bank, they see every single transaction. The government sees all of the transactions. So everything you do, because of course, they will eliminate the alternatives to this as well. So they get to see everything that you're spending money on, with whom, where, and when, all of that data. Now, note that I said a classic central bank digital currency, because the way that it was originally conceived, you don't need a banking sector. You only need the central bank. It does everything now. But this is where it starts to get juicy, of course, because we're now getting into this intra-elite competition. We've got the great setup for it. Now, this is one of those things. What I'm trying to do with this series is help you speak the language of finance. And when you can speak the language of finance, you start seeing this inter-elite competition occurring all over the place. And it's really been ramping up since the GFC, the 2008 financial crisis, because essentially what that triggered was a process of people realizing that the old world was over, and that for multiple reasons, the rottenness of the existing financial system, technology, demographic changes, geopolitical changes around the world, for a whole number of reasons, that the old world was going to come to an end. And I think what's been happening since 2008 is that a lot of the big elites have been starting to realize that once the music stops, they may not all have a seat. And they're fighting. They're not doing it openly. You're not going to read a press conference about how, you know, Merrill Lynch is trying to screw over the ECB or anything like that. But you can see when you follow the money flows and the agendas that are being pushed, there are some serious battles going on in the background about who's going to retain control once, like I say, the music stops. And this is evolving. So I want to sort of take you through one of the people who have, well, one of the organizations that has been sort of at the forefront of this. And that's the ECB. The reason that the ECB, so the European Central Bank, has been very much pushing this, and they really are quite aggressive on their timescale of pushing for this, is basically because they have to be. The Eurozone is in such a state that it could implode at any time, really. It's quite impressive that it hasn't imploded already. The dollar doesn't have to do that. So the Fed is not under the same level of pressure because they're top dog. We've got a dollar-denominated global financial system at the moment. So they're under considerably less pressure, and they can take their time and get it right and see what other people do. Similarly, the UK is under less pressure, not because necessarily our financial system is in wonderful condition, as recent events have shown, and also the enormous deficits that we're running, but the UK has less internal inconsistencies that the Eurozone does. It's very difficult setting monetary policy that works for Germany and Greece, just to name a couple of examples. But there was multiple things at the moment that are trying to pull the Eurozone apart, as well as it just being badly designed, it being a political project, them not sticking to the originals and the whole thing. So they really feel a sense of pressure that they need to get on with an alternative. So the case study that I'm going to give you is a couple of papers that the ECB has published, so you can track sort of in real terms over the last year or so how their thinking is evolving, where they're trying to get to, and some of the challenges that they face, because it's quite interesting to take you through, because of course this is a very new and emerging field where they're getting to, and the ECB is going first. So one of the first things that I noted about where we are with the EC, so the central bank digital currency debate these days, is there is another aspect, which is nicely spelled out in this paper, actually, that I didn't even consider 2 years ago, or two and a half, 3 years ago, when I first started really pushing back against this stuff in a public way. because I wasn't cynical enough. They are talking about different kinds of central bank digital currencies, specifically between a retail and a wholesale, or as I prefer to see it, a pleb coin and an elite coin. And this paper illustrates this quite well. And let's have a look at this graphic, which shows it quite nicely. So inside the bubble of pleb coin, as I call it, you've got the little people. So small businesses, people like you and me, and the government. And then outside of that sphere, using presumably the elite coin, is big businesses, big tech, and big commercial banks. So that was something that I didn't originally anticipate. I should update my dystopian scenario to include that. And they also talk about other things as well. So they talk about their complete and utter disdain for peer-to-peer payments. Again, going back to the last episode of Bitcoin, that was one of the great advantages. You did not need to use any bank at all. I could send you a Bitcoin transaction and you could send one to me. The people who are designing the central bank digital currency system don't like that ability to go direct. They want us to go through regulated banks. And that's probably because for the last at least 20 years, banks have been used as effectively policemen. There's been a huge amount of legislation that has gone in on anti-money laundering and other financial targeted regulation that turns banks into basically monitoring us on behalf of government and then reporting back every time they find something suspicious. So you can understand why they would not want to lose their biggest unpaid set of policemen. And there's another really interesting thing between these papers. I got a consistent theme when reading through it, but there's the conflict that they've got is that the central bank digital currency as they originally conceived it does not need banks, but they lack the ability to implement some of this stuff. They lack the know-how. They lack the ability to process transactions and do the policing that I've just talked about. So they need the banks. So they've designed a system that designs out the banks, and then they realize that in order to implement it, they need the banks, or at least initially.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.